All right, y'all, welcome to Naming It. This is Dr. Bedford Palmer, and I'm here. LaMisha is doing some other things right now. She's a little busy. She's doing some studies and whatnot. So we're going to do a bonus episode, you know, our real talk one-on-ones. And we have an amazing guest today. We have, like, I don't know how to start with this, but I'm going to keep it short because, you know, I can gush. I'll just keep going and going. But Dr. Kevin Coakley, I'm going to let him tell you everything, like, tell you, like, the important notes about, like, what he does and where he's at. But I'm going to tell you just a little bit about, like, this man and who he sits, how he sits in my life and in a lot of people's lives. Dr. Kevin Coakley is the most respected Black psychologist I know of. And I say that, I could say he's a well-known scientist. I could say he's a well-known writer. I could say he's a leader. I could say that he mentors students and he brings people up. I can say that, he's just a good all-around guy. There are a lot of really smart and wonderful psychologists out there and wonderful men and people out there. But Kevin is a person who people will follow, and not because he's, like, you know, out there trying to get that to happen. In fact, I think he's, like, trying to get people not to. But he is the most respected Black psychologist that I've ever come across. You can see it when you're around him. You can see it in students. You can see it in the elders as they move and what they're probably trying to get him to do. So I know he's probably blushing right now and he's like, why did I even allow myself to get on this, this podcast? But it's too late. You're here. You knew this was going to happen. So can you introduce yourself to everybody, Dr. Kevin Coakley?
Yes, and thank you, Dr. Palmer. As always, you are overly generous with your kind words for me. But yes, my name is Kevin Coakley, and I am a professor of educational psychology and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin, where I currently also serve as the director of the Institute for Urban Policy Research and Analysis, which is essentially a Black policy institute situated within Black Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. I've been a professor now for, 20 plus years. I'm starting my career at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, I taught for 6 years and got tenure, that's right. And from there, I went to the University of Missouri, Columbia, where I taught for 3 years. And then I was recruited away by the University of Texas at Austin in 2007, which is where I have been, for now 12 years. So I am a counsel psychologist, a very sort of proud counsel psychologist, one who has tried to dedicate my career to, you know, really sort of focusing on issues related to race, racism, racial identity, the achievement of Black students, and have taken very seriously my role as a mentor for students of color, especially for African-American students, and hope that I have been, you know, somewhat successful in doing that. So that's sort of me in a nutshell.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many layers there, and I want to get into different pieces of it. Is it okay if I tell them a quick story about us?
Sure.
So this is a story I like to tell people whenever I first bring them together with Dr. Coakley, because Dr. Coakley, Kevin, I know you rather probably me say Kevin, so I'm gonna go to Kevin. he's always been like a role model and a mentor, like a big brother in terms of, like, you know, as a professional and as, like, a, you know, a Black man in the field, someone to look up to. And when I was applying to grad school, I had the opportunity to potentially work with Kevin. And I was like, man, okay, I'm gonna apply. That's when he was at Mizzou. I was playing around and, I interviewed, it felt really good. And then I got waitlisted. but I was number one on the waitlist, But I was still waitlisted, okay. and I was beat out by a wonderful person who's amazing, who I've already bowed down to and said, yeah, I get it, you win. So Gioni, I'm just messing with you out there if you're listening. But like one of the cool things from that experience was that, like, even though I wasn't necessarily, like, we didn't end up, like, in the same department, in the same program, Kevin always kind of stayed connected with me. I wasn't just, like, this dude who, like, applied once and then bounced, you know? And so every time I saw him at conferences, he was still talking to me, and he was always wondering and asking about how well I was doing, you know, and how I was progressing. And he was encouraging and pushing and doing all the things that an advisor or a mentor is supposed to do, even though he had no responsibility from an official space to do that. And I've always been grateful for your mentorship and your help and your friendship. I tell that story because I think that it shows, I'm hoping that if a grad student listens to that, or anybody out there who, you don't necessarily end up in the space like that you're striving for at first, doesn't mean that like those relationships aren't going to like be a positive thing. It doesn't mean that it wasn't a good thing to do. It doesn't mean that that you should like feel bad, you know what I'm saying? Because you end up where you're supposed to end up. You know, I ended up at SIU Carbondale. That was a wonderful experience for me. It made me who I am as a psychologist, but I also had the experience of working with Kevin outside of those spaces, and yeah, so I just want to throw that out there for folks.
All right.
Yeah. Like, okay, so I'll get off of me and focus in on you. So you already kind of told us where you're, you know, what you're doing, and like kind of like, you know, explain kind of your bio around stuff. I'm wondering if you can dig a little deeper into like how your work intersects with social justice.
Yeah. So, you know, it's been really interesting, my evolution as a scholar. You know, when I first started off in the profession, I was really working hard to prove myself in the academy. I, you know, did not come into the academy, you know, as a really heralded, sort of individual. You know, I didn't have a lot of publications, and so I really focused on trying to publish and trying to prove myself. And as I, you know, began to do that and became more comfortable as a professor, I started to think more about sort of what I really wanted to do and really how I want to be remembered. And social justice has definitely always been part of my orientation as a scholar. And once I became more comfortable in the academy, it really sort of began to express itself even more. So for me, I have an unapologetic love for Black people, first and foremost.
Right.
And particularly, you know, the person who was a very influential mentor for me, Dr. Asa Hilliard, was a tireless defender and advocate for the unlimited potential of all Black students. And he was someone that I learned from, that I, you know, really tried to emulate in so many ways. And looking at what, you know, happens to our Black students in schools all across this country, you know, I understood that they, you know, were under siege, and that they needed people to defend them, to sort of speak on their behalf, to sort of help people understand, you know, who they are, and that they have dreams and ambitions as any other group of students, and that they are oftentimes misunderstood and stereotyped and mischaracterized and mislabeled. So for me, I think my social justice orientation was grounded in this orientation around the defense of Black students in these sort of predominantly white educational spaces. And so, you know, much of my early scholarship really focused on that. And I tried, and that was part of the reason why my orientation around being a strong mentor was so important to me. My own personal experience in graduate school and the doctoral program was not the best. And so I wanted to make sure that I gave to students what I unfortunately was not able to receive myself. And so so that's sort of where it started from. Now, as I continue to sort of, you know, grow professionally, and once I sort of was, you know, got past the stage of feeling the need to kind of prove myself, I began to, you know, sort of branch out and started to do more what I would sort of call sort of public engagement, you know, sort of writing for the public and speaking more broadly on issues pertaining to race and racism. I felt that I had, you know, finally sort of gotten to the place in my career and had achieved a stature that I was able to speak on some of these issues in ways that, you know, perhaps would, you know, make me sort of be seen as more sort of authoritative or credible. And so my social justice sort of orientation really began to sort of focus on just addressing very directly some of the injustices that I see happening all around us. So whether it's talking about the killings of unarmed Black men by law enforcement, or, you know, whether sort of more recently sort of talking about, you know, the travesty that is the current state of the presidency and the current state of the country, I have really felt the need to speak on these issues in ways that I know could get me, you know, in trouble, or certainly, you know, will cause some people to be, you know, upset with some of the things that I've said. So for me, my social justice is the metaphorical pen to paper, or sort of me sort of writing and very directly addressing these issues pertaining to sort of race and racism and prejudice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think, like, you know, you mentioned that you say things and you kind of put out information that could potentially get you in trouble. And I think that might be an interesting thing just to, like, talk a little bit about the fact that while you say that, it feels like when I look at, like, the work you've put out and the institutes you built and all the infrastructure around you, there's a certain amount of shielding you've kind of built through your own, you know, your own excellence that makes it so that, you know, you can say certain things. And I just wondered if you might say just a little bit about that for folks who might be wanting to build themselves the same way.
Yeah. So a couple of different things. You know, as a professor, one of the things, you know, that we sort of value is, you know, sort of the ability to sort of speak truth to power, and really sort of pursue those things and say those things without any sort of concern about, you know, repercussions. I mean, you know, you have academic freedom is sort of what we sort of say in the academy. And so when you feel, as a professor, you feel like once you get tenured, and, you know, and obviously that process is sort of, you start off and you're sort of, you know, on probation, so to speak, and you sort of work for, you know, 5 or 6 years to kind of prove yourself and your teaching and research, particularly. And then once you are sort of tenured, then, you know, for many professors, it sort of opens up this, you know, sort of doorway to academic freedom and to sort of really, you know, being much more vocal and saying those things that you know, really have wanted to say, but felt like you couldn't because you were concerned about job security. Mm-hmm. And so, for me, you know, you certainly started to see a shift in me sort of being much more vocal, certainly in my sort of writings and my public writings in particular. Now, I occupy a really interesting space because I'm a tenured full professor at a, you know, sort of, you know, tier one sort of research institution. I also, as I mentioned earlier, I direct the Policy Institute. And directing this Policy Institute is interesting because I have, you know, we're here, you know, in Austin, Texas, which is the capital of Texas, and I interact with policymakers and lawmakers and legislators. And the president of the University of Texas, it is his job to sort of, you know, make sure that the University of Texas at Austin is in good sort of standing with these legislatures. And Texas is, as you know, is a very conservative state. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of conservative policymakers. And so when I speak, or when I sort of write, I have to make sure that I don't present my views and my opinions as representing the University of Texas at Austin in any sort of official capacity, or representing the Institute in any official mm-hmm. capacity. Mm-hmm. And as you might imagine, it becomes very, very dicey right. because people know who I am, people know my affiliation, and they will assume that I am sort of saying something that represents an official stance of the University of the Institute, and that is not, you know, really the case. And so, you know, so for example, when I speak out against the current administration and all the sort of atrocities and the, you know, all the things that we know is happening regarding just, you know, the rampant sort of racism and the sort of anti-immigrant mm-hmm. stance and all the things that we know that's sort of happening. And when I sort of write about those sort of issues, it makes some people uncomfortable, and it has been brought to my attention on more than one occasion that I need to tread very carefully because people are paying close attention to what I'm saying, and they're looking at the Institute. And so when the director of the Institute writes an op-ed that gets published in a national media outlet that says, for example, that, you know, Trump is trying to make America white again, you know, something mm-hmm. to that effect, mm-hmm. then people start to say, what's going on over there? And is our are our dollars as sort of taxpayers supporting what they see as a liberal agenda? So those are the sort of things that I had to negotiate. And I guess it puts me in sort of a somewhat different place than maybe, you know, someone else who was maybe just focused on teaching and doing research.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, so it sounds like one of the things that success can actually put you into a space where you have much more scrutiny, and you have to like be more careful. It's funny because as you were talking, I was like thinking like, man, I'd be talking all kinds of smack on here. And I'm not, you know, and I'm going up for 10 years this year, and I'm trying to like work this out. But, part of the freedom for me is that I am small and that not that many people listening to me. So, I'm wondering what it might feel like to like get to that space where like, you know, that scrutiny comes, and like, I guess I admire the fact that you're able to still push and say what's honest and true, and that's on your heart, and that's needed for the public, you know, even with the fact that people could call in and be like mad that, you know, this leader in this community isn't saying stuff that they agree with. So I appreciate you sharing that. The next question that I wanted to ask you about is, with all the stuff that you're doing, I mean, like, you got this institute, you got your teaching, you got your mentoring, you got family, beautiful kids, you got all the stuff that's going on, travel the country. What keeps you motivated? Like, what makes you want to do the things that you do, especially in terms of like the harder social justice oriented things that are like, you know, you don't have to, and it might even make your life easier if you didn't, but you still kind of push.
Well, you know, that's a good question. And it might sound odd for me, you know, to sort of say this at the tender age of 50, but I'm sort of at the place in my sort of life and career where I'm really thinking about my legacy. And I want, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot about how I want people to remember me, and what was the meaning of my life. Mm. And I don't want people to sort of think of me as someone who, you know, simply, you know, got his PhD, you know, was a good researcher, good teacher, and that's it. Like, I really want to be remembered for having, you know, really made a difference in some sort of way. Mm-hmm. And so when I spend the time that I do with my students, when I say the things that I say knowing that they will be, in some instances, provocative and maybe unpopular with certain people. I do that because I don't want to sort of be safe, if that makes sense. I mean, I want to make a difference. And it sounds so generic and you know, so cliche, but I'm serious when I say that I want people to look at Kevin, you know, look at Kevin Coakley and say that, you know, here's someone who lived a good life, who really cared very deeply and passionately about, you know, his students, his friends, his family, who spoke truth to power without fear of consequences or repercussions. Mm-hmm. That I want people to be able to say that about me. And in fact, part of what I've done during the course of my life professionally is I've spoken out and said those things that have sometimes been unpopular. You know, those sort of so-called sacred cows that, you know, you're not supposed to, you know, talk about sort of publicly or address. I've done that because I felt like it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so I want people to, so what motivates me is just, you know, wanting people to see me as being just more than someone who got a degree, who was pretty smart, and who did some research. I want to create a legacy, and I'm always sort of thinking about that, and that's what motivates me.
You know, I think that that is, I think you might be the first person that we've done this with that like has like put it, laid it out in that way. And I think that, I mean, it's really powerful. And it's something like personally, I think I've been beginning to think about. So, you know, you're saying your ripe old age of 50, which, by the way, y'all, if you ever see Kevin Coakley, brother, don't look 50. Like that, I'm like 50. Like, ain't he like, 38 or something? I mean, I know he's older than me and I'm 40, but the brother looks young. You know, I think that, you know, as we get kind of older and, you know, we start to see the people who we looked up to, because someone that we both share. I mean, I know that you had a hard time when Dr. Hillier passed, and we kind of, I didn't get to know him very well, but we also shared Dr. Joseph White, and when he passed, we had a few strong conversations and shared some feelings around that, and it changes your focus, you know. It changes what looks like the most important thing when you see how finite things are, you know. And right. And so I feel that, and I think that if not that you need this validation, but I mean, bro, you leaving like the legacy that you build in. I mean, it's a beautiful legacy. As you were talking, I was also thinking about like, you know, what's our, if we were going to like take ourselves back to our ancestors, like who are we in these spaces and whatnot? How are we spoken of? And I feel like there's a certain privilege that comes with the things that we do, that we have access to, the voice that we're able to kind of have. And, when I think about you, I think of like this warrior who is pushing forward this agenda. I mean, we don't have to use, you know, physical weapons because we rhetorically approach things. And I think that the changes, they come from that. So yeah, I'm gonna pull back, but I just wanted to, I'm feeling a lot of things that coming from what you're saying. And I feel like some of that is similar for me. I see a mirror in that.
Oh, well, thank you, brother. I appreciate that.
Well, you know, like I said, you're like I'm always watching you trying to figure out, you know, what's the next step? How do I do this a little bit better? That's definitely like one way that I see, when I see you moving through spaces and I see you, doing your thing. So I know you don't have a bunch of time, so I want to move to the next question. We have two more questions. So with all the things you're doing, all the stuff, you know, as you have all these different things that are pulling at you, Even right now when we're talking, it's like you're taking off time in the middle of the day. This is family time. I appreciate it. All our listeners appreciate it. You can tell Gigi I'm sorry, and I'll if I need to like buy a drink sometime, or if I just need to watch Issa, I'll do what I need to do to be on her good side. I'm wondering, like, how do you take care of yourself? Like, how do you keep yourself healthy and moving forward so that, you know, we can kind of continue to have access to you?
Well, you know, I try to remain, you know, somewhat physically active. Way back in the day, I ran track in college, and I played sports in, you know, high school, and so I've always valued you know, physical activity and working out. You know, as you get older, you know, it gets a little bit harder, but I, you know, try to commit myself to working out, you know, a couple of times, you know, a week. And for me, that's really important, because when I find that when I do work out, I feel better not only physically, but I feel better mentally. You know, dare I say, even spiritually. I mean, it's just, you know, I feel better all the way around. So that's the number one way that I try to take care of myself. I try to make sure that I have quality family time. I could probably do better than that, because one of my vices is that I am a workaholic. And so I, you know, I'm always sort of, you know, thinking about, you know, the next thing that I need to be working on. And so, you know, I need to sort of make sure that I'm always fully present, you know, when I'm, you know, home and not sort of thinking about work. And so being with my kids, especially, and just enjoying them is very important for my well-being. And I try to make sure that I do that. Of course, you know, like many people, I think, I try to, you know, take a vacation. It was interesting, because growing up for me, the notion of a vacation in my family was driving from North Carolina to rural Mississippi to see my mom's side of the family. And not a very, you know, not a very sort of sexy sort of vacation, you know, trust me when I say that. Right. And so that was really the only thing that I knew about vacation. And then, you know, of course, when I, you know, got married and my wife was able to kind of help me expand that notion of what a vacation is, and you know, showing me that, you know, when you go on vacation, you really should go to, you know, some place that, you know, you can sort of relax, you know, preferably with water, even though I don't swim. So taking out the time, you know, to just go and just re-energize and renew yourself, is also very important too.
I hear that. Yeah, I'm with you on that. I will sit out and I will look at that water and enjoy it, and I don't have to touch none of that. So it's like, go ahead. I don't need to put myself back in the food chain. I'm good. Okay. So like working out, taking care of your body, also giving yourself some space, some time off. Another piece in there is like listening to the people who love you, who give you advice about how to do that, you know? So like, we don't all grow up with every single path to self-care and to health and wellness. And sometimes we get a partner and they'll tell us, you know, they'll give us what they learned, or we'll have friends and they'll tell us what they learned. And so like being open and able to kind of take in that, I think that's a really cool piece that maybe some folks can take in too, and maybe add some new routes for their own self-care.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, all right, we're at the last question.
All right.
And so one of the things about naming it is, so we're a social justice podcast. We focus on the intersection between, you know, social justice, psychology, and blackness. And part of that is that we have to call out the elephant in the room. We spend a lot of time like looking at and saying like, look, this is this thing, this big old thing that nobody wants to talk about. And we're going to go ahead and just like pull that out and say, look, it's sitting right there. Let's at least acknowledge it. And so one of the things that we like to ask people who come on for the one-on-ones is like for them in their life. So for you in your life, based on the concerns you have and the spaces that you move in, and like particularly like from a perspective of, I know you go out and you get interviewed sometimes and you do writing and like people kind of come in with agendas about what they want to know from you. What I'd like to know is like, what's that question? What's that elephant that people don't usually ask you about that you wish they would ask you about that, like you could kind of shine some light on?
Man, that is a really deep question, Dr. Farmer. When I saw the question, I was like, I have to be honest, like I had an answer that I thought would be, you know, relatively easy to sort of to say, but I think it's probably a bit superficial relative to sort of what I think you're really trying to get me to explore. So let me tell you what I was going to say initially,
okay.
And then maybe as I'm talking, maybe I can think of, you know, a better response. But when I saw the question, I initially thought to myself, well, the elephant in the room that we need to call out would be Black people who support Trump.
Ooh.
and there are more of them than they tend to be Black men.
Yeah.
Although certainly there are some Black women. And, you know, and that really baffles me. And I don't understand it. I don't know if it's an elephant in the room per se, but it's something that I think should be called out because I just don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that what you were getting at is probably a bit deeper than that, maybe.
And we can go wherever you want. I mean, I didn't mean to, you know, it's like I'm wherever you are and wherever you want to think about, we're good with that. If something is kind of starting to scratch at you, then let's go there too.
Well, I mean, you know, so here, I'll say this, and I think you could appreciate this because of previous conversations that we've had, mm-hmm. about an organization that we both are very familiar with, the Association of Black Psychologists.
Yes.
And I think one of the, you know, an elephant in the room that I think that certainly Black folks need to address is, you know, how we negotiate our relationship, you know, with white people. And what I mean by that is, do we, because of history,
mm-hmm.
do we sort of keep ourselves in a posture of perpetual mistrust, where we are always sort of reacting to white people and to sort of racism and in a way that I think puts us in a position of I don't want to say weakness, but it just leaves us always sort of reactionary.
Right.
And I say that because I think that we sometimes we give our power away.
Yes.
To white people.
Yes.
You know, we've seen it in our organization because of sometimes it's sort of, you know, reactionary nature. And to me, we need to move beyond that, you know, sort of respecting it and acknowledging our history, but not giving away our power, not giving white people too much power.
Right.
And I think that sometimes we do that as a people.
Yeah.
And And it's difficult to talk about because it makes it sounds like to some that I'm saying that we should just move past history, that history is the past, and that we need to just sort of get over it. And I'm not saying that at all. I'm definitely not saying that at all. But I do feel like we sometimes, because of the pain that is associated with sort of our history and contemporary sort of circumstances, that we sort of find it difficult to see or to have relationships with white allies and other allies as well, without sort of seeing them as inherently sort of against us. And so to me, that's something that we need to, in my opinion, continue to work on.
No, we have talked about this, and I think we share similar opinions. I have a real hard time with that idea of the hiding part of it, you know, like the and I guess like the way that I would that I've kind of seen it is like this whole people they're valuing comfort over productive work, you know, like it's comfortable to be in our own spaces by ourselves to in like an echo chamber where whatever we say everyone's going to give an amen to. It's deeply uncomfortable to say the same thing in a group full of white folks, you know. It's deeply uncomfortable to like be in the in a leadership space and actually have to fight them to get what you need for the community. And it's a vulnerable space too, because you know you are in danger. There's bad stuff that can happen, but there's also you're there's opportunity in having that contact. So like yeah, it's I feel you on that, and I wish we could. I feel like there needs to be a dialogue about like learning how to kind of, and in fact, there's, you know, Dr. Thomas Parham talked about self-actuation and like looking at that concept for folks culturally as putting a bubble around yourself of your own culture and your own safety and being able to walk through these other spaces. And I see you navigate that so well. You know, you move through these spaces. There's no like when you go through APA, it's very interesting. You move through APA like you own that space, and I dare someone to question your blackness. Like that's not on someone's head at all. You know, like it would be like it's like one of those things that if someone said it, everybody's looking at them like Kid and Play looked at Blau. You know, I scratch my neck and look away, man. Y'all crazy. Kevin Coakley? Kevin, y'all don't know Kevin Coakley, you know? But yeah, so I think like it'd be very interesting to actually have to fully have that conversation. And to talk about it from like both the perspective of like, yeah, we understand there's trauma, but trauma, I mean, if we're all psychologists, we know that the way that you deal with trauma is by confronting it. It's not by pretending as though or living back in that past where you know, so I'm gonna get real nerdy and I'm gonna try to cut it because I know you got places to go. But you know, from a trauma perspective, from someone who treats trauma, the biggest problem with trauma is that people don't know the difference between right now and the moment when they had the trauma occur. Right. And so their body is reacting as if they're back in that traumatic moment. And so when we talk about cultural trauma and racial trauma, a lot of people like to like latch onto that and say, this is why I can't do this. I think that the better way, the more healing way is to say, no, this is why you have to do it. Like the only way that we're going to heal from this stuff is if we are able to kind of go in and really like confront the thing that scares us, and you can tell that, and I'm gonna put myself out on a limb here, because we walk in the same communities, but you can tell that because when you're at some place like ABSci, there are folks who have been sitting in ABSci for like decades and never have kind of crossed that line and gone out there, and you can feel the it's palatable, the pain, you know, and it's as raw as it was when it first happened. And so like when we talk about healing and we talk about growth, I feel like, yeah, you're right on. We need that. That is definitely an elephant in the room. That's totally part of our culture, and we got to deal with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And would you mind if I share just one more that just came to mind?
Oh, yeah, I mind. Yeah, I don't want Dr. Copley say what's on his mind on the show. No, please, brother, tell, share with us.
Well, and the other sort of elephant in the room that I think has been exposed somewhat because of the Me Too movement, hashtag Me Too movement, mm-hmm. is the Black community's tendency to sort of protect bad behavior and bad conduct amongst, you know, by prominent Black men. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we now see, you know, with Cosby in jail, and it looks like R. Kelly, finally, you know, justice will be had there. But we've known in our community for years about these behaviors. When I was teaching at Southern Illinois University, I had students, you know, young female students who were from Chicago tell me that it was well known that R. Kelly would go to high schools and prey upon high school girls. And that was, now I started teaching 1998, and it was well known at that time. Mm-hmm. And yet we as a community, and this is actually connected to my earlier point, because of our trauma around racism, we had a difficult time, you know, pointing out that what he was doing was harmful to our community. He was harming Black girls. He was harming Black women. But because he was a prominent Black man, some of my community felt like it was, you know, basically a white man trying to bring, you know, a Black man down, and there was this need to sort of try to protect him. You know, same thing with like Cosby. Mm-hmm. You know, you would hear people say, "Well, look, Woody Allen. You look at what he did. And give all these other excuses." And my response to that would always be, "Look, I don't care about what these other people are doing. They're not in our community. I am a Black man, and I care about what's being done that's harming our community." Mm-hmm. And so we have this sort of protectionism, you know, for Black male misbehavior that we need to sort of talk about. And fortunately, we're starting to see a little bit more of it, mm-hmm. in terms of sort of, you know, talking about it. But that's something that to me, is an elephant in the room.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like what I'm hearing you describe is kind of this community orientation that like we get caught up in this intersectional space where we can't figure out what should be most prime, you know, race or gender in certain ways. And then like from a community right. perspective, you know, what you just said that I think like really stuck for me is like, we're focusing in on what an external community is doing to us instead of focusing in on our responsibility to our own community members.
Right.
Yeah. So like, I mean, I think that maybe that'd be a way that people would better be able to understand it. It's like, look, this isn't the greater U.S. community's responsibility to fix. This is our responsibility. We use those methods. We can call the police because we pay those taxes and stuff and get the courts to do the stuff. But like, we got to protect our women. We got to protect our men. We got to protect our kids. You know, we can't rely on other people to do it. And we can't sit there and like act like stuff isn't happening. So yeah, man, I think that's something to talk about in at all levels. Like we're talking about organizations, right. and institutions and schools and businesses. There's a lot of folks out there who are scared and should be, and maybe they need to make peace with people before, you know, the real comes out, you know, and the real still needs to come out. But yeah, if you out there afraid, dude, you need to do something about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, okay. I know. See what some of y'all might or might not understand is that when you vibing with the brother, you could end up talking, and I'm pretty sure that if I just kept letting it go, my brother Kevin, he would just keep talking to me. But because you know what I'm saying, like we gotta take care of home and we gotta take care of each other. I ain't gonna let you do right? that. plus, you know, I do not want Gigi to be angry at me. So we're gonna move forward. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on. I've been wanting to do this for a really long time, and it just, you know, it just hasn't happened. And so I wanted you know, we had studio time. I just saw you at the conference, and I was like, man, like let's see if this can happen. And just like in short notice, you gave of your time, and you really showed up, and I really very much appreciate it. Thank you, Kevin, for coming on.
Well, thank you, Dr. Palmer, for having me on. And, you know, you are doing some great work. And, you know, in your own right, you are someone who people should look up to and admire, because you are definitely a social justice warrior. So thank you for all that you do.
I'm sitting here blushing and fanboying right now. And if y'all don't, if you didn't notice, just because I gotta do the process thing, because that's where I live a lot. Like, so I, you know, Dr. Coakley has me call him Kevin, and he pushed that forward, and then he turns around and he calls me Dr. Palmer because I'm his junior, and he's bringing me up. Don't y'all think that, please do not believe that this man did not calculate what he did right there. That's a mentor. That's a scholar. It's a gentleman. I look up to you, man. And, yeah. Like, thank you again. Yeah, y'all. That's it for today. Keep naming it. Check us out on social media. Actually, before, I almost forgot. Kevin, where can Dr. Coakley, where can people find you if they want to, like, find out about your research and your work, or, like, check you out on social media?
Yeah, so then check out my website. It's www.kevincoakley.com.
Okay.
And, you know, you can, if you're interested in any of the op-eds or the public writing that I've done, there's a link there that will, you know, show you all the public writing that I have done, which is, you know, pretty easily accessible.
Okay. And don't you have like a social media account?
I do. I do have a Twitter account. It's, you know, at Kevin Coakley one, the number one.
Okay.
Do I have anything else? I think I might have opened an Instagram account, but I haven't really used it yet. So.
Okay. So we got Twitter, we got the website. For the folks out there, you know, I'll say this one last thing. If you're a student who's interested in going to a counseling psychology program and learning how to be a social justice psychologist, learning how to be a psychologist who's gonna kind of work to build the social good and to support people and to deal with culture and multiculturalism and diversity. If you're a Black student who's like looking for a mentor, Dr. Kevin Coakley, he puts people through. I see people come through his program and then they're doctors, and it's multiple people, you know. So like if you're trying to finish, and you're out there, you're putting applications in this season, you need to be thinking about Austin. You need to be thinking about trying to get in there and be Dr. Coakley's number one pick. But I think now with his gravitas, he gets number 2, 3, 4, and 5, probably too. So you got a better shot than I had this time. So get out there, get with, like, you know, pursue that. And, yeah, so that's it. You can find me at DRBF Palmer. Naming It is at Naming It Podcast. At Naming It Podcast, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You know, Lamisha's still out there. So we'll have her come back and we'll have a full episode with the co-host when she's back and she's available. We miss you. Thank you to Megasonic. Thank you very much. We call him Dr. Megasonic here. The studio producer, this is amazing being in here. And to Lee Nguyen Jr., the soul violinist. All right, y'all, keep naming it. Peace.
All right, peace.